This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Hello and welcome to the National Museum of Australia. It's fantastic to see so many faces here. We are really privileged. We've got an exclusive viewing of an international documentary film which has an amazing story. So we're going to have for people who don't know me, my name's Libby Robin. I'm Senior Research Fellow in the National Museum of Australia. And we're going to have a short introduction to the film from our international guest and filmmaker, Greg Mittman. Then we'll have the film, which is 27 minutes long. And then we're going to have a Q&A and happily hear from you and have a bit of a talk about the stories that this film raises, because it's really, I think it's a very exciting film, but it's also got a really interesting backstory. So without further ado, Professor Greg Mittman from the University of Wisconsin in Madison is here to tell us about why he's been in Liberia.
Thank you. Thanks, Libby. Thanks, everyone, for coming out for this. So I have been, I'm a medical historian, environmental historian, and have been working in Liberia for the past 3 years, making a different film, making a different documentary. And we were doing a film shoot in Liberia last June when the first Ebola cases appeared in Monrovia. And knowing what I knew about the public health infrastructure of Liberia at the time, was a bit concerned about where this would be headed. This was before there had been a lot of international media coverage. I left in early July, before the epidemic really ramped up. But one of my grad students, Emmanuel Yuri, who's the subject of this film, stayed through the end of July and got one of the last commercial flights out. And by late July, a number of commercial airlines, British Airways and other airlines, stopped their flights to Liberia. And we were quite disconcerted by the kind of media coverage that we saw coming out about the outbreak, about the epidemic, a coverage that really reinforced a lot of Western stereotypes about West Africa. Some of the initial coverage, in at least in the U.S. and places like the New York Times, focused on the quote irrationality and superstition of West Africans for attacking international healthcare workers, which really was ignorant of the history and culture in West Africa that was causing the outbreak to unfold the way it was, particularly the history of the civil war in Liberia and Sierra Leone, which led to great mistrust toward government. In Liberia, Liberia has long been a place for American biomedical research, going back to the 1920s when a Harvard medical expedition was there on behalf of Firestone, which was establishing the world's largest rubber plantation, doing experimental drug testing on indigenous populations. One of the members of that expedition, Max Theiler, would go on to win the Nobel Prize for the development of yellow fever vaccine, work which began on that expedition. So there has been, through the history of Liberia, a lot of suspicions about particularly American biomedical research workers working in Liberia, all of which would shape the unfolding outbreak. So my Liberian friends and colleagues and I made a decision in July to begin documenting the process, documenting what was happening on the ground, really trying to get a perspective from Liberians about how this was unfolding the way it was, because we were seeing a lot of international coverage about international aid workers. We were seeing a lot of coverage about Liberians as victims. We were seeing very little coverage about what Liberians were doing themselves to really deal with this outbreak. So we began following this story in July, continued to shoot through November. We didn't really know how this story was going to end. And then in January, decided to complete the film. The film is a very collaborative medium. This film was made across three different countries, Liberia, the U.S., and the United Kingdom. Our Liberian cinematographer, Alexander Wiapla, was really on the front line getting a lot of this footage, risking his life to be able to gather the voices and perspectives of Liberians. So with that, I will let it run, and then afterwards, Libby and I will be doing a Q&A. I know that for Australians, Liberia might seem quite remote as a country. There are Australian mining companies there, BHP. Liberia sits on the purest iron ore in West Africa, and now with the end of the Civil War and post-war reconciliation and development, there's a lot of multinational companies in there interested in extracting natural resources. Australia was also the first developed country to issue a travel ban on West Africa and to deny visas for West Africans during the Ebola outbreak. So the outbreak does connect directly to what's happened here. So, thank you.
Can we have the lights up a bit more, do you think? So we can see people, that's better. Thank you. Wow, thank you, Greg. But that's better. Thank you. I was very taken with this movie, seeing it again. I've seen it twice now. Ebola is something we hear about as a sort of a disease that needs fixing, as something that's about science. David Quammen has written an excellent book about it, actually, if you're interested in the disease and the science. And it's like a detective story. What's causing it? How can we cure it? But your film's not like that at all, Greg, because you're a historian. Can you tell us a little bit about the different motivation that you have when you are working from the bottom up, from people, from where you're trying to perhaps cure a disease? And we've just heard the World Health Organization has just announced that this disease is no longer epidemic, so it's off the... You won't get that piece of paper at the airport saying Ebola anymore, I think, as of Sunday. So just tell us a little bit about the other end of things, how you start from the other end.
Yeah, I think... So I teach courses on global health, and you know, one of the things that I always try and impress upon my students is that the biology is easy, it's the social that's hard. Mm-hmm. And that... you know, I think one of the things in terms of, you know, why the outbreak unfolded the way it did was a real lack of understanding about the cultural and social dimensions of it and the ways in which the history of the Civil War issues around infrastructure really shaped what was possible and not possible. And so, you know, when dealing with an outbreak like this, I mean, the biggest thing, the biggest challenge is really how do you build trust? How do you build trust among people? How do you build community trust? And when you have people walking, you know, into communities in these, you know, scary-looking hazmat suits. In an area where Ebola had not been known, had not been seen before, you know, it's why you see in the film, initially, there's a lot of disbelief and fear. You know, and I think... also, you know, that we saw the kind of consequences of what quarantines and travel bans mean, and I suspect that, you know, that would have happened in a developed, you know, if we did a quarantine, a militarized quarantine in a developed country, the same thing would have happened.
And it cut people off from food, in fact, and made things much worse for them. But it was worse in Liberia because they already had bad relations with the police and the border control because of the civil war. And that, I think, is something that people who think that there should be a one-size-fits-all quarantine solution all around the world, like the World Health Organization says this is the way it should be done, maybe we need films like this to explain that the local people are going to respond differently to that the hazmat suits are themselves scary.
Right. You know, and one of the things that's happened in the context of global health since the 1980s through what's called structural adjustment and the way in which the World Bank has given money to developing countries is there's been a lot of focus on what's called vertical programs. So a focus on targeting single diseases like, you know, the malaria or polio or things like that without an attention to the basic medical infrastructure and public health infrastructure. Mm. And had that been in place, I think the way in which the outbreak happened would have been quite different. You'll see widely varying figures about how many doctors there were actually in Liberia at the time, anywhere between 50 and 200. This is for a population of 3.5 million people. So we're looking at one doctor per 100,000 people at the time of the outbreak.
We're starting to see some hands. Yeah. I'll start with Roseanne Kennedy, and then you're next.
Hi, Roseanne.
We'll just wait for the mic.
One of the things I was interested in was a comment made by the president of Liberia, and she said, you know, this is a transnational disease. And I guess I was thinking about...
Hold it closer.
I was thinking about the issue of the transnational when she said this is a transnational disease, but also thinking about the responses of closing borders. I mean, exclusion, and that is such a typical response. We're going to close these borders. And you see that within Liberia. We're going to have a quarantine, and then in the U.S., and then thinking about really the need to have a transnational response, which is what I guess eventually happens. So I wondered if you could comment a little bit on that. I think that's an interesting issue around borders. And I also just wondered about how different or similar the situation in Sierra Leone was, because they also had a long civil war there not so long ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the issues around quarantines and travel bans, I think, are deeply tied to issues around trade and trading partners. So, for example, the 2003 SARS epidemic, which was a much more contagious disease, it's respiratory. During the SARS epidemic, there was never any discussion of a travel ban. And why is that? I think one of the reasons is because China was a major U.S. trading partner. And what do quarantines do? They really damage economic trade, right? West Africa is not an active trading partner, you know, of the U.S. or other nations, and its economies are so small that it's easy to think about putting quarantines, right, and travel bans on, because it's really not going to impact other countries economically, although it had a huge impact on places like Liberia and Sierra Leone and Guinea, where food prices really escalated and you had all these other ripple effects. So I think it's deeply tied. Questions of quarantines and travel bans are deeply tied to issues around trade. And we see that throughout the history of epidemics across the globe, going back into the 18th century, really. Things happened very similarly in Sierra Leone, although the post-colonial politics of really shaped the way in which it was handled on the ground, you know, Sierra Leone being a former British colony. Liberia was the only, was the first independent free republic in Africa. It was never a colony. It's long relied on close relationships to the U.S. because it was founded, well, it was partly founded by free blacks that were sent there by American colonization societies in the 1820s. But when they arrived, there were already 16 indigenous groups there. So it's a little misleading to say Liberia was founded by free blacks from America. The post-colonial politics certainly shaped the way in which the international community responded, Guinea obviously being connected to France.
Gentleman in the red scarf, thanks.
Yeah, congratulations. I enjoyed particularly a film coming from the ground up.
Thank you. You
had the tremendous advantage in that you had a local technician who appreciated the significance of epidemiology. I suppose the only other comment I would make is that it would have been tremendous if you could have had an extra element in there from outside Monrovia, but I realise that that probably would have been impossible to generate. I'm XUN, to me it's a really classic case of epidemiology of a contagious disease. I wasn't in West Africa at the time, but it seems to me that it was really very, very sad while NGOs were screaming, not for days, but for months, the World Health Organization really didn't respond properly for months, and I'm embarrassed to say that our government here responded in, to my mind, exactly the wrong way. I suppose that's... I don't have a question, I just have those comments.
Thank you for your comments. We actually did... We were actually following... we did have footage from what was happening in rural communities. When you said outside Monrovia, I didn't mean know if you meant in the rural landscape or... And it's... Because of length, we weren't able to include it, that material, but it was quite interesting in the ways in which rural villages were dealing with the outbreak. They enacted their own quarantine measures towards strangers, going back to the way they dealt with strangers during the Civil War, and also although I can't verify this, but probably a kind of memory about the ways in which they rural communities dealt with other diseases like smallpox. So one village that we had been filming in, they made it a requirement that if you were a stranger to the community, you would have to, you couldn't come into the village, and you would have to reside on the edge of the village, not with direct contact with people for 3 weeks before you were allowed into the community. So, we heard a lot about, irrationality and superstition, but communities were responding on the ground level in really effective ways.
We have another question here, and then perhaps you, after that, pass it forward. Oh, that's right.
Thanks, Greg. I was very struck by the introduction of 250,000 people dying in the Civil War, and I thought that it was a really impacting way to sort of bring history into what was shaping the experience of Ebola. I'm wondering if you can reflect on the comparison of at the end it says 8,400 people died from Ebola, and the mammoth global response to the Ebola crisis as opposed to the Civil War.
Yeah, interesting. That figures now, the statistics now, to just bring the film up to date, is 11,000 people died, 26,000 people infected. One of the things that we saw so often is basically a lot of Liberians were referring to Ebola as the invisible war. It was a lot more frightening than the Civil War because they said, at least in the Civil War, you knew where the enemy was coming from and you could run in the other direction. But in the case of Ebola, that wasn't true. And the other thing that was so, I think, disconcerting in terms of the memory of the war is things like roadblocks. Which were instituted during the war, those were the places where people were killed. So roadblocks were a very threatening place for Liberians who had lived through the war, and that just invoked that kind of memory. In terms of, the differential response, we saw there when the UN peacekeeping force was 15,000 troops that were sent there in 2003. There's now about 7,000. But so much of that focus was on getting guns out of the population, right? It was all about trying to eliminate violence in terms of direct conflict, with without any really attention to public health infrastructure. And, you know, if some of those resources had gone into that, I think we would have seen this quite differently. I mean, similarly, you know, the way in which we are living in a kind of global world now of biosecurity, which has a kind of very militarized approach to epidemics, what does the U.S. do? We send troops. What does Cuba do? They send doctors. And, you know, when people have asked me, well, if you were advising Obama, what would you have said? I would have said, send money to those Liberian hip-hop artists and musicians and community leaders who were actively on the ground building trust and getting the message out, not sending the military.
Hello.
Thank you.
There are just so many things to points of discussion from that short film. It's extraordinary. One of the things that really struck me was the issues around barrier nursing, and there are a lot of depictions of breakdown of barrier nursing clearly depicted there. Mm-hmm. And even in a country like Australia, we have problems with barrier nursing. So isn't it now, when outside organisations such as the United Nations and places like Australia, that we should be on the ground now teaching these people, educating them prior to any more outbreaks of Ebola or anything else?
I couldn't agree more. I think, you know, it's a fantastic observation. And, you know, you know, now Ebola's out of the headlines, it'll be forgotten, yet the medical capacity and infrastructure is still not there. And so all we need is another resurgence, and the whole thing is going to happen all over again. There has been such, you know, I mentioned that Liberia has long been a place for American biomedical research. Since Firestone was there in the 1920s, there was a Liberian Institute of Biomedical Research that was established in the 1950s, funded by Firestone and the American government. Yet there was all of that work was, it was just work that was done by Americans. There was no effort really to build medical capacity and training within the country. And so that's the consequence that we see, right? When you have a country where there's 50, you know, to 200 doctors, that absolutely what's needed, I think, is really to focus on building medical capacity and knowledge within Liberia. And nursing is a huge one.
And perhaps even more urgent, there's another question here in the front, but while you take that microphone, even more urgently, they seem to be worried about food right now.
Yeah.
And that's a sort of, it's not just, it's some sort of structure for coping with the aftermath, the afterburn
right.
of these events.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we were, I mean, unfortunately, in a sad way, gratified to see was that a lot of the issues that we pointed to in this film around food insecurity and so forth, have turned out to be true. I mean, so there was a recent social survey done by a group at MIT in Monrovia, and the largest issue right now facing people living in Monrovia is food insecurity and hunger.
And water.
And water.
Water,
yeah.
Your question.
Thank you very much for your film. I was wondering whether you had any figures on brain drain as a consequence of the Civil War,
yeah.
And whether that was also perhaps a contributing factor in the lack of trained personnel.
Absolutely. So during the Civil War, which lasted from 1989 to 2003, those that had the means and education left, right? There's a large Liberian diaspora community in the United States. And so a lot of that medical knowledge left as well, and that has certainly shaped the way in which the outbreak unfolded the way it did.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the film. Most enjoyable. I've got a comment and a question.
Hold the microphone close.
Okay, that's better. I was working in Rwanda late last year when this was the epidemic was at its height, and I contrast the public reaction there with what we had in the West, in Australia, for example. There wasn't the sense of panic. there wasn't the border closure. Yes, there were strict quarantine provisions in place, but the Rwandans, with the relatively insignificant medical resources they had, immediately sent a team of 14 medicos to the West Africa to try and contain it. And it was interesting, the fact that from the West we were having, you know, the panic that the Ebola is upon us. There was concern and there was precautions, but nowhere near the sense of panic that was here. The other question, the question that I have is, your film showed us very much the work of the local people, medical staff, community workers and what have you. What was the real impact when the international community got its act together? Is that what really was able to turn the tide in terms of the current situation?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. I mean, I don't think we can ever really know. But it's interesting, if you look at the epidemiological curve, in the case of Liberia, the numbers really start dropping of new cases and deaths by early to mid-October. Before the first Ebola treatment unit was built by the Americans. So there's some indication that, you know, I think, and recent analyses that have been coming out, that it really was community organization and mobilization at the community level within Liberia that really began to stem, turn the tide. You know, certainly once you had Ebola treatment units there, the survival rates, would greatly impact survival rates of people, because they were getting adequate medical treatment, they were getting intravenous fluids and so forth. So I don't think we can say it was one over the other. Obviously, it was a combination of that. But what was so, you know, important to us was that that side of the kind of community mobilization we hadn't been seeing in Western press coverage, right? We were always seeing kind of the focus on the heroism of international aid workers. And fantastic that they were there. I mean, Médecins Sans Frontières was really out on front in dealing with this, and you know, it's really fantastic they were there. But we really felt that there was a major missing element to the story, and that was what was happening on the ground.
I think we'll take this as the last question because we're getting close to time. Thank you.
Sorry, I was just wondering if there's any chance of getting a copy of the film on video.
So this a version of this film, a slightly shorter version, will be released online through the American ITVS Independent Lens. It's a part of the PBS, or the Corporation for Public Broadcasting in the U.S. will be released online in late June. And will be available free for anyone to watch.
And we'll make sure that the details about that are put on the National Museum of Australia website, so you can follow it up. Late June, you say?
Yes.
Yep. Look, I just wanted to thank you all for coming and for a great set of questions, and thank Greg very, very much. This is one of the collaborations between the Centre for Environmental History, and this is an interesting environment because it's the environment within we're talking about, and the National Museum of Australia through research. And I've just got a little parcel for you, Greg. It's a parcel of three books that are other collaborations between the Centre for Environmental History and the National Museum of Australia. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thanks, everyone.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.